Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
My name is Hilda. I am an alcoholic. And I really want to thank the committee. Ralph mentioned last night about their diligence. I thought it was personal, but unlike Ralph, I thought it was because they thought I was a flake. I wasn't looking at being special, so, you know. But they've been terrific, and I've really had a good time with Melissa, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd loved listening to Ralph last night, and Jerry's workshop today. Let's see. I guess I'm the baby of the lads this week. My sobriety date is the 20th of July, 1993. I have a sponsor. Her name is Sharon Crane. Some of you may have heard her last year. please don't compare. I truly believe my sponsor is the best speaker in Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to believe that, but it helps that I do. And I have a home group, which is the Pacific Group in Los Angeles. And I was born in London, in case you were wondering. I grew up in a pub. I really did. My grandparents owned the pub. I'm an only child and only grandchild. And only children like me are very good at entertaining ourselves. I'm sure there are other only children here tonight. For me, my playground was the cellar. You know, I loved it. My playthings were the bottles. And I used to line the vodka bottles up on one side and the whiskey bottles up on the other, and I'd have the whiskey bottles chatting to the vodka bottles and be chatting to me, and I'd be chatting to them, and, you know, vodka was always the good guys and whiskey was the bad guys, and... You know, the only sad part about that is it was still happening in my 20s, you know. I just had a thing about alcohol from the gate. You know, I loved the colors of the bottles and the shapes and the labels, and I just loved it. You know, and growing up in a pub, one of my favorite smells to this day is the smell of stale hops in the morning. You know, there is a brewery out near Pasadena where I used to live. And whenever I go out the 210, I still put the windows down for the ambiance, you know, drive through. You know, I just loved it. I loved everything about it. And when I was my granddad's pub, it's sort of in the shape of a U, with two bars in the front, a little hallway, a long bar out the back, the kitchen, and then another bar that was called the Dive, which was a little bar out the back. And the parking lot was in the back with a little door through the alley. And my bedroom was right above the kitchen, and it looked down into the long bar. Now, the two front bars were very civilized. You know, one was called the cocktail bar, and the other one was called the front bar. Because it was in the front, you know. But my bedroom window looked down into the long bar out the back, and the long bar was where life happened, and I loved it. You know, from my bedroom window, I used to watch all the goings-on, and the long bar is where they had the fights and the pool tournaments and the discos, and the police would come and bottles would get broken. And I'm telling you, from my bedroom window, it was better than telly. You know, it really was. I loved it. And I'd sit up there, and they had this thing in London when the licensing hours, and they would shut. My granddad had this thing called lock-in. And what he would do after hours is he'd lock all the doors, he'd turn all the lights off, he'd put the jukebox down really low, and the regulars got to stay, and they would drink into the night with my granddad. And the only lights that would be on would be the neon lights that glowed through the optics. From my bedroom window, it was magic. It just looked magic. They looked so special. And one night, I snuck down, and I poked my little head into the long bar. My granddad saw me, and he flagged me in. And he popped me up in a bar stool, and he gave me a baby sham. And a baby sham then was a little bottle, and it had like a cartoon deer sort of leaping on it, you know, like that. And And he put it in a little glass, and I loved it. You know, I have no clue whether I got tipsy that night or even if I liked the taste. It didn't matter. I had arrived. You know, I just loved that feeling. And, you know, I think I probably spent the rest of my drinking trying to get that night back. You know, and of course it never happened. You know, it never happened. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about me around page 33, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember things very well. but it says something like, it doesn't matter how much you drink or how often you drink, it's what happens when you drink. And that many who are merely potential alcoholics often become the real thing in a short amount of time, particularly true of women. And I am one of those women. You know, by 16, I had an ulcer. At 17, I got done for drunk driving. At 18, I had a heart attack. And 6 months later, I was in a mental hospital. And that's when drink was working. You know? It all went downhill after that, you know. Over the next 3 years, I was in and out of mental hospitals. The longest I was ever out of a mental hospital was for 2 weeks together. And in those 2 weeks, I was in my own flat. I had the curtains drawn, 56 channels of Nutton on the telly, and a fridge full of Osti Spumante, vodka, and Michelob Light. Because I was always watching calories, too, you know. but for those 2 weeks, I did nothing but drink. You know, I didn't answer the phone, I didn't talk to anybody, I didn't see anybody. And I have a clear memory of standing in the shower, drinking a cold Mick Light, thinking it just doesn't get any better than this, you know. And what happened was I got a knock on the door one day, and it was my mom, my shrink, two policemen, and two nurses. And they shot me in the arse with something, and they put me in a jacket with really long arms. And I came to in the Institute for the Living in Hartford, Connecticut. And I really thought that I was on candid camera, or I'd been punked or something, you know, because it was very surreal to me, because I found out I had been committed for a minimum of a year for being a danger to myself and others. I hadn't seen anybody for 2 weeks. I kept thinking, who are the others? You know, just didn't seem right, you know. And anybody who's been in a facility like that knows that the people in those places are crazy. You know. Now, I knew there was something wrong with me. And I knew they didn't know what it was. You know, because I don't believe I've ever been the full ticket. I don't believe I'll ever be a full ticket. Quite honestly, I don't think there's a program in the world that will make me a full ticket. What I do know is that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the tools that allow me to act as if I'm a full ticket. And I'm running with that today, you know. But at the time, I'm in this mental hospital, and I know they don't know what's wrong with me, and I know they don't know what to do with me. But my roommate, it was very obvious what was wrong with her. You know, my roommate had rage attacks. One minute she'd be fine, the next minute she'd snap. And she'd start punching out windows and going for nurses, and it was chaos. And I'd sit on the bed in the fetal position reading, you know, nothing going on here. Nope, I'm good. You know, because they did this thing called wet packing. And they would tackle her to the floor, wrap her in cold wet sheets, and toddle her away. And when she got toddled away, she'd be away for a long time. I never knew where she went, you know. But she had something I didn't have, and that was friends locally. And her friends used to smuggle money in all the time. So our room always had money hidden in it, all over the place. So when she'd get toddled away, I'd start thinking. You know, I'm a thinker. And I'd start thinking, what a waste it is to leave all that money just sitting there. Somebody should do something with it, you know. So I would go AWOL on her dime. And I went AWOL this time. I had $50 on me. And I ended up in downtown Hartford, and I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do. And this little fellow wandered up to me, and he said, do you want to buy a ticket to Prince? Now, I didn't know who Prince was. I am truly an AC/DC Black Sabbath kind of girl. But I'm thinking a dark auditorium. This might work, you know. So I get these tickets, I smuggle these two bottles of vodka in, I'm sitting in the nosebleed seats, and while he does his little raspberry beret thing, I'm getting legless, you know. And after the concert, I'm wandering around Hartford, and I ended up in the park. And there were these winos in the park, and sitting in kind of a circle, and they were passing a bottle. And I sat down with them. And they kept looking at me like, stupid or crazy. They never said a word, and they were good as gold to me all night. Let me drink with them. And as dawn came, the white van with the blue letters pulled up, Institute for the Living. And I stood up and said, I got to go, my ride's here. That's a true story. And of course, these fellows just looked at each other like, yep, crazy. You know. So I'd get back to the Institute, and I'd have to build up my little trust points. You know, we all, those of us who have been there know. And, you know, I just didn't get it. I didn't understand what was going on. And I'd coming towards the end of my time there, I was getting very tired, and I wasn't going as far. And this one of the last times I went AWOL, I ended up in this pizza place right around the corner from the hospital. And I thought to myself, okay, Hilda, this time we're going to do it like a lady. We're going to do it properly, right? So I go in, I order a slice of pizza and two pitchers of beer. And I go sit down in the booth, and I'm pouring the pitcher into the glass because we're going to do this properly, right? Like a lady. So I'm pouring it into the glass, and just as I get started, some of the nurses from my unit walk in on their lunch. So now I'm down in the booth with the pitcher up to my mouth, you know, trying to get as much down me as I can before they see me, you know. Just complete madness. But when my year was coming to the end, I had to go before a board of psychiatrists. And my psychiatrist stood up and said, Hilda will never live in normal society. She is completely incapable. And his suggestion was that I do another year, minimum. And it took me over 2.5 months to convince the board to let me out. And you know, in hindsight, I think that shrink might have had something. You know, because I got out and I went wild. I moved from Hartford to Hamden, which is just down the road. I got a little job and a little flat, and I met a fella. And this fella turned out to be a coke dealer. And I had never done coke before. And I tell you, the attractive thing to me with coke was that I could drink longer. And I didn't eat, because I'm still watching my weight, you know. And so I've got this little job. And in a really short amount of time, I was making $700 a week. In a relatively short amount of time, I had a coke habit of $1,500 a week. And when you do the math, it wasn't coming out terribly well, you know. And what happened was one day I was sitting on the counter in my kitchen, and I was drinking a case of McLite at the time. And I remember looking out at my flat and thinking, Hilda, you sold everything for coke, including your curtains. I thought, if you're hanging out with people who will buy your curtains, we have a problem here. And you know, I never touched coke again. I would be in parties and people would be doing coke and my little head would say, nope, remember the curtains. Now, I think that's what makes me a real alcoholic. Because I can tell you, far worse things happened to me with alcohol than ever happened to me with coke. But never once did my head ever say, you shouldn't drink. Never once. What my head used to say is, you should stay away from the whiskey because it makes you mean. You know, stay away from the red wine because it makes you cry. You know, or my version of chapter 3, switching from scotch to brandy or scotch to randy, you know. But it never said, don't drink. You know, and I think that's the difference. And so I'm in Connecticut, and I get done for drunk driving, drunk and disorderly, indecent exposure, and I think I never should have left England. It was so much better there. So I moved back to England, and I wouldn't be back in England very long, and I get done for drunk driving, drunk and disorderly, indecent exposure, and I think America was so much better. What was I thinking? You know, and I have a long list of arrests for indecent exposure. And I know I don't really look the type now. I don't know, maybe I do. But something happens when you add alcohol to this alcoholic. And I know I'm not alone in Alcoholics Anonymous because I've heard other women share it. But as soon as you add alcohol to this alcoholic, for whatever reason, I feel like I have to show you my tits. Now, I tried everything for that not to be true. And I know that that's part of my alcoholism, because I don't feel the need to show them to you now. So I'm back and forth and back and forth, and I'm back in England this time, and I'm tending bar with a mate of mine, Andy. Andy and I are great mates, and his birthday was on New Year's Eve, so we started drinking on Christmas Eve, as you do. And I'm a blackout drinker. I've always been a blackout drinker. I used to call it losing time. You know, I lost a weekend, I lost a couple of hours, losing time. And I actually got a tick when I was drinking, where I would look at my watch all the time, right? Because I really believed if I could read the time, I wasn't in a blackout. What I found out is it only told me what time it started at, because it's the last time I can remember what time it was, you know what I mean? But I was a blackout drinker, and so Andy and I started drinking on Christmas Eve, and on the 3rd of January I came to in my flat. Starker's naked, and the flat was wrecked, and the phone was ringing, and when I answered the phone, it was my mate Andy. And he said, "Are you ready to pick out rings?" I said, "Excuse me?" And he said, "Oh, no, not this time, Hilda." Now, he brought over a video, and I'm on this video, and I look great. I look great. I am not slurring my words. I'm not walking funny. I have a drink in my hand the whole time. It's all our friends. My father was there. I'm watching the video. Andy went down on one knee, and I yelled, "Say no." You know, because I wasn't there. I didn't remember any of it. And yet, there I was, saying yes on the video to getting married to my mate Andy. So I did what I did best, really. I panicked, and I went to the pub. And I ended up chatting to the fella in the pub. You know the guy who knows everything? There's one in every pub. And I know there's a few of you here. You know, he's the guy that knows everything about everything. In fact, he is the most interesting man in the world. Right? I mean... So I'm talking to this fella, and I'm telling him about, you know, poor old me, I'm engaged, and I don't know how it happened, and I can't marry this fella, and yada, yada, yada. And he said, "Did you know, if you volunteer on a kibbutz in Israel, they do your laundry, you get 3 meals a day, and they'll pay you 50 quid? And I thought, result. 3 days later, I'm in Golders Green, I'm getting my visa, and I'm on my way to Israel. I'm a good Irish Catholic girl. It all made sense to me. So I said to my dad, "I'm going to Israel to work on a kibbutz, and it's going to be good. I'm going to work hard." And my father said, "When you get off the plane in Tel Aviv, can you just shout at the top of your lungs, 'Has anybody seen Hilda?' It'll save you some time." And I had no clue what he was talking about, you know. So I get to Tel Aviv. I'm on this kibbutz. I went for 3 months. I stayed 9. I came out of a blackout in a Tel Aviv jail charged with drunk driving. And I didn't remember renting the car. And I can tell you that really horrible things happen to young, vulnerable women who drink like I do in places like that. And when I got out on bail, I jumped bail. I went to Egypt. And I ended up with the wrong people in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I can tell you that really horrible things happen to young, vulnerable women who drink like I do in places like that. And I ended up getting dumped outside the American Embassy in a tattered T-shirt, a beat-up pair of shorts, pair of loafers, not another thing to my name. And I went to the American Embassy. I'm a dual national. And a big Marine on the gate took pity on me. You know, it was Ramadan and everything was shut, including the embassy. And him and his mates looked after me until the embassy opened. And when the embassy opened, you know, I got an emergency passport and they got me a flight. And, you know, I truly believe that a non-alcoholic woman who had been through what I had been through would think about never drinking again. But I'm an alcoholic, and I'm a goalpost drinker. I'm one of those drinkers that says, "Well, if it gets bad, and I move that goalpost back just a little bit." And I think, "Well, if it gets worse, I move that goalpost back just a little bit more." What happens is I'm not 20 minutes in the air, and I'm already drinking, thinking, "Hell, they could have killed me." By the time I landed in London, I was legless drunk. You know, and the bottom line is I didn't know how to stop it. I didn't know it was the drink. I just didn't know. And the whole 80s for me are a bit like the Talking Head song, Once in a Lifetime, where he goes, "This is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife. How did I get here?" The whole 80s is a bit like one big long blackout with little bits of reality thrown in, you know. And coming towards the end of the 80s, I was starting to come to, and I realized I was in a relationship that apparently I had been in for quite a while. And I didn't know what to do because all of a sudden she's commenting on my drinking, which I just thought was rude, you know. And I'm getting in trouble, and things are getting repossessed, and it was all out of control. And I just didn't know what to do. And I thought about going back to the States. So I went back to me mom, and I was staying with me mom, and I wasn't with me mom very long, and she started commenting on my drinking. And I was really getting frustrated, and I thought about my uncle. Now, my uncle tried to 12-step me when I was 18 in a pub in St. Albans in England. And, you know, he was on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember him saying, you know, "Hilda, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you need never drink again." I was 18. I thought, why wouldn't I want to drink? But he could see where I was going. So now I'm back at my mom's, it's all gone horribly wrong, and I started thinking about him, because he was still sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, my uncle was what I thought a real alcoholic was. You know, my uncle went to prison. I only ever went to jail. You know? My uncle went to detox centers. I only ever went to mental hospitals. You know? So in my mind, he was a worse alcoholic, or a real alcoholic, and yet he was still sober, and there was something about that. And I decided I would try this Alcoholics Anonymous thing. So on New Year's Eve, 1989, I went to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Papillion, Nebraska. And I chose New Year's Eve because I truly believe that no real alcoholic would quit drinking on New Year's Eve. I know today that only alcoholics have to mark the calendar. Non-alcoholics never put a little square around when they're stopping drinking. They never think about it. You know, that thing like virgins not going for pregnancy tests. It's that same thing, you know. I didn't know that then, you know. So I go to this meeting in Papillion, Nebraska, and it's a very small meeting. They're all sitting around this little table, and they're talking about, "He's the father, we're the children," and I thought I was screwed. I thought, if that's the answer, it's never going to work for me. I've always been a seeker. You know, I went to Israel, please, you know. So I knew that wasn't going to work, so I couldn't hear anything else anybody said. And in fact, I started taking people's inventory by their shoes, because I can't look at you either. And the fellow sitting next to me had on the biggest pair of cowboy boots I had ever seen. And I started thinking, I wonder if his IQ is any bigger than his boot size. You know, I'm tearing these people to shreds. And after the meeting, I made a beeline for my car, and this big dumb cowboy walked up to me and said, "Have you got a big book?" I said, "Of course I have a big book. Doesn't everybody have a big book?" Now, I wouldn't have known a big book if you had beat me with it. But I couldn't tell him that, you know what I mean? But without missing a beat, he went straight to his truck, and he gave me his big book. And it really affected me, because it was the first time anybody had seen straight through me. And I was speechless, and I went to get in my car, and this little old woman ran up to me and said, "Did you know, if you go to a lot of meetings and you don't drink in between, you can't get drunk?" Wow. Thank you. I got in my car, I'm thinking, these people are freaks. You know. But I tell you what happened was, as I drove away, that little woman's voice resonated in my head. And I thought, she might have something here. If I went to a lot of these meetings and I didn't drink in between, I might stay out of trouble. That's what was attractive to me. And that's exactly what I did. And I was one of those people who got really well really quick, super quick. Got the job, partner came back, my mom's starting to like me again. You know, I'm in California, and I got a sponsor because people were giving me a hard time about not having one. You know what they're like. Yeah. You know, so I picked the oldest, frailest woman I could find and asked her to sponsor me. You know, I figured she wouldn't give me a hard time. And of course, I was wrong. But basically, for about 3 years, I went to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did service when you asked me to. And I sat in the room thinking, my name's Hilda, I'm an alcoholic. Well, my mother thinks so. My uncle thinks so. My partner thought so. But you know, I'm still in dry, clean, only clothes driving a nice car. My life's getting good really quick. I really started to believe that the steps were for those of you who were unwell. And there seemed to be quite a few of you. You know. Arrogance and ignorance is what I suffered from. And I was about 3 years sober, and my sponsor got cancer, and she was dying in the hospital. And I went to see her one day, and you know, I know today that she was probably the closest thing to a higher power I ever had. But she knew, because I went to see her in hospital when she was dying, and she said, you know, Hilda, just remember, Alcoholics Anonymous will be here for you when you come back. I hadn't drank yet. I didn't know what she was talking about. So she passed away, and I pulled away. I went from 7 meetings to 5 to 3 to 2 a month, 2 a week, 2 a month, once a month, because now I'm busy. You know, I'm busy. I'm in Florida. I'm on my way to my dream job in Germany, the job I had always wanted. I'm walking on the beach with my partner, and my partner turns to me and says, you know what, Hilda? Not only do I not like you, I don't love you anymore. And I thought, are you kidding? 3.5 years I haven't had a drink for you, which was my other problem. So we go to the airport. I put my partner, my now ex-partner, on a plane. As the plane takes off, I walk into the pub. I start with double Jack, because that's how I drink, because I'm thinking nobody in Germany thinks I'm an alcoholic. And we know how the Germans drink, right? So I started drinking on the Thursday. I arrived in Germany on the Sunday. I started my new job on the Monday. I got done for drunk driving on the Friday, and I woke up in a wet bed next to my new boss on Saturday morning. That's my drinking. Glamour drinking. And you know, I've heard people say, if you want to pick up where you left off, pick up a drink tomorrow. That is so not my experience. When I started drinking after not drinking for a time, my drinking was 10 times worse and more. You know, the people I woke up next to were uglier. The beds were wetter. My blackouts were longer. It was just all bad. And I drank like that for 9 months. And I can tell you, at the end of my 9 months, I woke up in my own bed, which had become a bonus. It was the morning after what I hope was my last night before. And I was still dressed from work, which was really normal. My hose were all ripped. I had a great gash down my face. And I went into the bathroom, and as I was washing my face, there was blood everywhere, and I had no clue what had happened the night before. And, you know, I had that moment. I heard people in Alcoholics Anonymous share about the hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And I think, God, you're so dramatic. Whatever. That morning, I knew who they were. And I tell you, my heart broke. Not because I can't drink. I drink with the best of them. But because I realized I could no longer drink safely. You know, I did not care when I was unpredictable to you. I got frightened when I realized I had become unpredictable to me. And I didn't know what else to do, so I phoned English-speaking AA, and I spoke to a fellow called Steve Baker. And he lets me break his anonymity, by the way, so don't talk to me about it. Steve Baker, I told him my sad old story. Poor old me, been to Alcoholics Anonymous, screwed it up. Wine, wine, wine. And he said something I truly believe saved my life. Because he said, you know, Hilda, the most natural thing in the world for an alcoholic to do is drink. That's what we do. And that's why in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't shoot our wounded. And I believed him. It's the only reason why I went to a meeting that night. Because I thought he understood. You know, so I suffer from a mental illness called alcoholism, which means driving over to this meeting, I'm thinking, I don't want anybody to think I'm new, right? I don't want anybody to think I don't know what's going on in here. You know, I memorized chapter 3. I memorized chapter 5. And not just where it says God could and would. I'm talking about chapter 5. You know, because I needed to sound good. So I'm driving over to this meeting, and I think, what I'll do, I'm thinking about the meetings in Florida and California, these huge meetings like this size, and where I'd go 5 minutes late, leave 5 minutes early, and call it a home group. You know, if you're new, that doesn't work. But I get to this meeting in Holmesbrook, Holland. There are 7 people in this room. It's an hour and a half meeting. And they're not letting me pass. So I tell all of them my sad old story. Poor old me, been to Alcoholics Anonymous, screwed it up. Wine, wine, wine. And, you know, at the end of the meeting, they were looking for somebody to make the tea and coffee. And I was thinking, I hope they find someone. You know, that's an important commitment. And from across the room, I heard this voice go, "Hilda will do it." And I thought, Hilda who? This meeting was Tuesday, Thursdays, and Saturdays. This is Tuesday night. And I said to this woman, "Look, I don't know if I'm going to be sober on Thursday. That seemed like a long time to me." She said, "If you want to stay sober, you'll make the tea and coffee." Now, my little head's going, "Who is this psycho woman, and why is she picking on me?" But my mouth just went, "Oh, okay." I was tired, and I was out of ideas. You know, if you're new, I really hope you're willing. You know, Ralph talked about the gift of desperation. You know, I hope you're willing as the desperate can be, because I would have done anything that woman suggested, and I tried, because I just didn't want what I had. You know, and so I'm making tea and coffee. You know, I made tea and coffee in this meeting for a long time. Now, I never drank coffee when I was drinking. And it took them about probably 9 months to tell me my coffee sucked. Because I was seriously unlovable when I came to you. It talks about it in the big book. The alcoholic in his cups is an unlovable creature. And I truly was unlovable. And just a piece of work, you know. This woman who became my sponsor pulled me aside and said, "You really need to try 90 meetings in 90 days. I said, "Do you see where we are? Holmesbrook, Holland. It is nowhere hang a left." She said, "Well, I know, Hilda, but you know, they have a meeting in Dusseldorf on Friday nights and Kaiserslautern on Wednesday and Hahn on Monday." And I was like, I said, "I am not driving all over God's Acre for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not happening." She said, "How far did you drive for a drink?" It's like, oh. Because I am that drunk at 2 in the morning driving around for anything open. So I started driving to all these meetings, and I tormented my home group. Every Thursday night I'd say, "I'm going to Dusseldorf tomorrow. Does anybody want to go with me?" Right? Because I was frightened. Because when I was drinking, if I got lost on the way to a job interview once, I pulled into a B&B, got 2 bottles, and called it a day. So driving to Dusseldorf, I was a little nervous about it. So I tormented my home group. And you know the guy I hated the most. Hated. Always went, "I'll go with you, Hilda." Like anybody but you. But sure enough, Mike would show up every Friday and ride with me an hour and a half to Dusseldorf for an hour and a half's meeting, for an hour's coffee afterwards, for an hour and a half's drive home. And I wanted to kill him the whole time. I have left skid marks on the Autobahn where I have pulled over to tell him to get out. And of course, he had 7 years, so he would just laugh. He'd go, "Just keep driving. I find it easier to drive when I'm not driving everybody else's car." I'm like, "Get out!" You know. Madness. Complete madness. And, you know, we did that to Kaiserslautern, we did it to Dahan, and, you know, I'm so grateful for that foundation. You know, I'm grateful for where I got sober because I learned principles before personalities early on because I had to. I hated all of them, you know. And I made the... Sandy became my sponsor, and what happened was I was reading something in the big book one night, which I just thought was stupid, but it hit me. It said, you know, "Is there something you should tell somebody immediately?" So I called Sandy. It was about 2 in the morning. She never slept. Kind of an odd thing about her. I don't know. She was always awake. So I called her at 2 in the morning. I said, "Sandy, I'm reading this thing in the big book, and it says if I have to tell, so I need, do you think you could sponsor me?" And she starts laughing. She said, "I have been, but thanks for making it official." Now we've got a sponsor, you know. It was mad. She had the patience of a saint with me because I argued and debated every step. every step. I just couldn't take it for what it was. And one day I'm in her kitchen and we're going through the book, and I said, well, I know what it says, but do you know what they mean? And her book came sliding across the room, missed me by inches, you know. And I looked at her and I said, what are you doing? She said, Hilda, when you read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, just read the black bits. There is nothing in between the lines. What they say is what they mean. It's exactly what they want you to do. And of course, I'm a mumbler, right? So I'm going, well, I don't think so. She was really good with me. And so I'm 9 months sober, and my company promotes me. And they move me to Belgium. Now, I go over to Sandy's. I'm sitting in her kitchen, and I said, Sandy, they want me to go to Belgium. She said, Hilda, what's the problem? I said, well, I'm not supposed to have any major changes in the first year, so I can't go. And she said, I'm really sorry your company didn't get the memo. Pack your bags. So I moved to Belgium. And, you know, I was a spoiled brat in Belgium, and I was miserable, and I hated it. And I did duvet therapy. You know, I'd get home from work, get under the duvet, get up the next day and hope it all changed. I didn't drink, but it didn't work, you know. And I finally gave in, and I called Sandy and told her I was miserable and I didn't know what to do and blah, blah, blah. And she said, why don't you blow the dust off your big book, get your happy little arse 20 minutes up the road to the Brussels meeting. They have a meeting every night of the week. And when you get there, I want you to share honestly. And I thought, fine. So I drive up to this meeting in Brussels, and I get there, and their coffee is like lead, and they have like no literature. So when I shared, I told them so. And of course, you know what happened was they gave me the literature commitment and took me to coffee, you know. And they saved my life again. You know, they were so good to me in Belgium. And when I moved to London, I did it all different. I got offered a job in London. I went over every weekend before I moved. I had a home group before I arrived. I had a service commitment waiting for me before I got there. People in AA helped me find a flat before I moved over. And it all went really smooth. And I learned a little bit about what you were talking about when you said about doing something different for a different result. You know, and so I'm in London. I go to this convention one day, and I hear this speaker say, you can do absolutely anything you want in Alcoholics Anonymous as long as you're willing to pay the price and do the work. And I thought, huh. So I get back from this convention, I go to work, I put in my notice, and I go on the dole because I've decided I'm going to change my career. I was going to go into a helping profession, you know, where I could help people. And I forgot one small thing in that, because I'm 2.5 years sober now, and I realized that I don't like people. Why would I want to help them, you know? But it's too late now because I've applied to universities and, you know. So I'm on the dole and I'm doing all this voluntary work. And when I was 4 years sober, I finally got accepted to university. It's very hard to get into university in London. And I got accepted to university and I got my first motorcycle. And I was about 4.5 years sober and I had a motorcycle accident. So I got a bigger bike. And I got a couple of tattoos. And I'm 5 years sober. I'm starting my second year at university. And I was the only one that was surprised about that. Nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous seemed surprised. And I used to think it was because people in Alcoholics Anonymous believed in me. And I heard a speaker who had a similar experience, and she said, no, what she realized was that people in Alcoholics Anonymous believing in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I was doing the deal. And I'm tootling along quite nicely in Alcoholics Anonymous. Sponsoring a few people, I'm going to school, getting a degree, and all of a sudden I'm 6.5 years sober, and the phone rings. I'm on my way to a convention in the south of England that morning, and it was my mom. And my mom had been diagnosed with breast cancer, and she asked me if I would go to California when she had her operation that was coming up in a couple of months, and I told her I would. Now, that may not seem like that big of a deal to you, but it was huge to me because nobody in my family ever gave me bad news. You know, whenever anything bad happened, I went on a bender and made them worry worse. You know, I'd disappear for days. So the fact that, A, my mom told me she wasn't well, and B, she asked me to come was amazing to me. So I went down to this convention, and as I'm driving there, I'm thinking, I don't want to tell anybody what's going on, because conventions are supposed to be a good time, you know. So I'm standing in the registration line, and this fella who has known me since I got sober walked up and said, "Would you share at the midnight meeting?" I said, "No." He said, "What?" I said, "No, not up for it." He said, "You know, actually, Hilda, you look like you need to share, and there'll be nobody there. It's a midnight meeting. The old-timers meeting is going on at the same time. It'll be fine." I said, "Fine, I'll share." So I go to this midnight meeting. There's about 250 people in the room. And for the first time ever in Alcoholics Anonymous, I cried when I shared about my mom. I had never cried. It was the very first time. In fact, when you cried, I used to tap your knee, you know, sorry. I had no frame of reference, you know. But I cried when I shared about my mom, and what I didn't realize was that my outsides were starting to match my insides, you know, and I was starting to thaw just a little bit. And my whole sobriety changed that night because a fella I barely knew stood up in the back of the room and offered me a flight to California if I couldn't afford it. The fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous touched me that night because I realized for the very first time I was part of something bigger than a meeting, that I was part of a fellowship and that I was in the middle of the bed, and everything changed from there. You know, I did go to California when my mom had her operations, and I made sure I was there when she woke up and I was there when she went to sleep. And the old 202 Club in Pasadena used to be right across the street from the hospital, and I'd shoot over there to meetings and then shoot back to the hospital. And oddly enough, and Julie has a friend who always says, "Is that odd or is it God?" Oddly enough, because of what I had done at university that didn't finish, they let me take my mother home early, and I got to nurse her at home. And I was emptying my mom's tubes one day, and you know, it was really odd because my whole sobriety, I kept asking my sponsor, how do I make amends to this woman, my mom, whose heart I broke over and over. You know, my sponsor often says, if you're sitting in here tonight, 10 people are digesting their dinner better. You know, 10 people are sleeping well tonight because they know you're safe here. I often think of my mother with that because I robbed my mom of her sleep so many times. I called her collect from foreign jails when she could do nothing. So my sponsor kept saying, it's God's time, Hilda, not yours. And when the time is right, you'll know. So I'm emptying my mom's tubes one day, and my mom turned to me and she said, you know, Hilda, I don't know how I'll ever repay you. I said, you don't get it. 6.5 years, I have waited for this moment when I actually get to be a daughter. You know? And my mom and I have had a great relationship since. I love that thing, life is not measured by the number of breaths we take, but by the moments that take our breath away. Because that's been my sobriety. It hasn't been about the years. It's been about those moments. You know, when my mom's in remission, and when she had her 60th birthday, she wanted to go back to Ireland. And she asked me to take her for 10 days, me and mom. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and she said, just remember, Hilda, this trip is your mother's trip. So we go to Wicklow, where my mom was born and raised, and she shows me where she caught the bus and where she bought her sweets and where she went to school. I just wanted to shoot myself. But any time I wanted to make it about me, I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you reminded me that it was my mother's trip, you know. So she didn't know. And we had a great time, you know. And we were in Bray Mountain one day, and my mom turned to me and she said, you know, Hilda, I'm so proud of you. You've turned into a lovely young woman. My mom. That's Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I was living in London. I was working for a company whose head office was in New York. And I used to go from London to New York and back and forth. And I had a home group in New York because I'm not one of those people who can afford to be anonymous in Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to be accountable, even when I'm traveling. And I had this home group in New York, and I would go to the same meeting every time I was there. And I'm in New York, and I go to work that morning, and they offer me a corner office. Corner office on the 58th floor of the World Trade Center. I'm going to be a god. And quite honestly, it's about time. You know. I'm going to be a god. I knew they'd see my worth one day, you know. So I'm all full of going to be a god. And I'm thinking about my office and how to decorate it. And I'm walking. When I was in New York traveling, I would go hotel, work, hotel, meeting, hotel, work, hotel, meeting. That's all I did. So I'm on my way to the meet, and I call my partner, who's 3 months longer sober than I am, and we'll let you know that. I'm walking over to the meeting, and I'm thinking about my office. And I call Julie, and I said, pack it up, babe. We are moving to New York City. I'm going to be a god. She said, of course you are. Why don't you go to the meeting and call me afterwards? And I thought, it's not getting this. This is big, you know. So I'm sitting in the meeting, and I'm thinking about how I'm going to decorate my office and important things like that, the color. And this little fella taps me on the shoulder, and he says, do you remember me? And I looked at him, and I said, I'm sorry, I don't. In my head, I'm thinking, why would I know this kid? I'm going to be a god. So he taps me on the shoulder again, and I turn around, and he said, you know, I'm a year sober tonight. And it meant the world to him that I was there, because I shared at his very first meeting. And you know, I realized something that night, in that moment, that it wasn't about the corner office, and it wasn't about being a god. It was about being of service. It's about being of service to my mother. It was about being of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was about being of service to this kid. And I turned down the promotion. And I got back to London, and a few weeks later, the towers disappeared. And I got to be of service to my company, because we spent 36 hours answering phones, checking people off the list who just wanted somebody to know they were okay. Now, I only got to do that because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody else in our office, apart from me and one other person, were in the pub watching it on telly. Without you, that's where I would have been. But I got to be of service, you know. 8 years sober, we decided we were going to move to California. And we had a 5-year plan. We stayed 7, because that's what we do. And I have to tell you, Southern California changed my whole sobriety. It changed my whole sobriety. I was in a meeting one night in suburbia, and they were having a group conscience, and they were arguing over something. And they stopped the meeting and turned around and said, what do you think, Hilda? And I realized that 8 years of sobriety, I had the longest sobriety in the room. And I looked at these women and I said, if I'm all you've got, you're screwed. And I had been going to this other meeting across town and dipping my toe in, as they would say. And I decided I would, I talked to this woman who was a member of that group, and she invited me to the big meeting. And I went, and I went into this meeting, and she introduced me around. You know, anybody who's been to the Pacific group knows how that goes. And she introduced me around, and there's this one woman that every week I go remembers my name. And she always says, how are you doing, Hilda? And she was very present, and I had never been able to be present because I have a super busy head. And she was very present, and it really affected me. And, you know, this woman who took me there said, you know, what are you going to do? And I said, I think I'm going to ask her to sponsor me. And she said, well, why don't you get her CD and see if you have anything in common? Now, when we were in London, we went to the World Convention in San Diego. And we're in Jack Murphy Stadium, all these drunks, you know, and it was just an odd feeling for me because I just don't like you very much. You know, that hasn't gone away much, by the way. Just not a people person. But this woman shared about the price of her dignity. And the price of her dignity was the gloss being pushed across the bar. And that if the bartender had said, drink this and lose your dignity, she'd have said, make it a double and buy him one too. And I got that. And you know, I spent the next probably 8 or 9 years quoting that same woman, who I didn't know who she was, talking about my dignity, because it made such an impact on me. Because when I got sober, I couldn't even spell the word dignity, never mind have any. And so here I am driving home from this meeting years later. I pop in this woman's CD in the car, and it's the woman from San Diego, the dignity woman. So I get home, and I said, I found my new sponsor. It's the dignity woman. And so I started stalking her, as you do. And I finally asked her to sponsor me, and she said, you know, Hilda, you've been under the radar way too long. And I didn't know what she was talking about. She said, you know, read page 77 in our big book, because it tells you what you're supposed to be doing. And that is being of maximum service to God and your fellows. And you haven't been doing that. And it changed my whole sobriety because it reminded me that I have a purpose. Whether I'm making the coffee or I'm sponsoring women or I'm here, I have a purpose. You know, I have a purpose to carry a message. And it's only my message. And if you don't identify with me tonight, that's okay. Because there's three more speakers coming, you know. But, you know, I have learned so much from this woman. And I was going to Washington, D.C. for a conference. And my father died when I was in my 20s. And he left me a lot of money. And, you know, my dad had great hopes for me. He's buried in Arlington National Cemetery. And I didn't know that was a big deal. I just didn't know. I buried him drunk. I made a scene. It was just horrible. But they gave me a family pass when he passed away because I'm an only child. And when I was going to this conference, Sharon said to me, you know, it's time. It's time you go see your dad and clear this up. And we went to Washington, D.C. And, you know, I've traveled all over the world drunk and sober. And I still had this family pass. And I put my hand straight on it. And we got this pass and we drove to Arlington National Cemetery and you put it in your window. I didn't know that if you don't have family there, you have to go on a little bus like a tour. I had no clue. So I put this in the window and I drive in and they salute us as we go through the gate. And I drove straight to my dad's grave and I stood there and I realized my dad would be proud of me today, not because I've been of service to you or to my mother, not because I finished my bachelor's degree, 20 years and 7 universities, but who's counting? Not because I finished my master's degree, not because I have a good job or I'm in a good relationship. My father would be proud of me today because I walk with just a little bit of dignity. That's all he ever wanted, you know. The bottom line is, I came to you a lying bedwetting whore. That's the truth. And if you're new tonight, I want you to know that I truly believe that if somebody like me can get sober and stay sober, absolutely anybody can. Because I came to you a lying bedwetting whore, and somewhere along the way, you have turned me into a good friend, a loving and monogamous partner, and a true daughter to my mother. For that, I thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.